You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Genesis, Secrets of Creation, the First Book of Moses. 11 lectures given in Munich from the 16th to the 26th of August, 1910. Lecture 1, entitled The Mystery of the Primordial Word. If anyone who has a background of spiritual science and has absorbed something of what anthroposophy can tell us about the evolution of our world is able to find the way into those tremendous opening words of our Bible, it should be like entering an entirely new spiritual dimension. There is probably no account of human evolution so open to misinterpretation as this document, usually known as Genesis, the description of the creation of the world in 6 or 7 days. If a person of modern times calls to mind, in one of the languages spoken today, the words, quote, "In the beginning God created the heaven and the earth," close quote, what they contain for him can be termed hardly a reflection, barely a shadow of what lived in the ancient Hebrews when they opened their souls to the opening words of the Bible. In fact, with regard to this particular document, the last possible importance attaches to finding the equivalent modern words to put in the place of the ancient ones. And it is far more important that we prepare ourselves, through anthroposophy, to feel at least something of the mood which lived in the hearts and minds of the ancient Hebrew scholars when they brought to life within themselves the words, I'm going to give this a try, Breshit bara Elohim et hashamayim vet haaretz. What was it like, this whole inner world, which scholars experienced in the moments when these words flashed through their souls? We can only compare it with what can come alive in the soul of a person when he receives the pictures experienced by a seer who can see into the spiritual world. For what, after all, is being described to us through what we call spiritual science? We realize that these descriptions are the outcome of seership, of the living intuitions which the seer receives when, having freed himself from the conditions of sense perception and of the intellect bound up with the physical body, he looks with spiritual organs into the spiritual world. If he wants to translate what he sees there into the languages of the physical world, he can only do so in pictures, and if his descriptive powers suffice, he will do it in pictures which are able to awaken in his hearers a mental image corresponding to what he himself sees in the spiritual worlds. The resulting experience must, however, not be mistaken for a description of things and events of the physical sense world, and we must be aware the whole time that we are having dealings with an entirely different realm, one which does indeed underlie and maintain the ordinary sense world and the mental images, impressions, and perceptions which belong there, but which does not actually identify with it at all. If we want to portray the origin of this our sense world, including that of the human being himself, our ideas must not remain confined to the sense world. No science equipped solely with ideas taken from the world of the senses can reach the origins of sense existence. For sense existence is rooted in the supersensible element. And although we can go a long way back historically and even geologically, we must realize that if we want to arrive at the origins, we must, at a certain point in the primordial past, leave the sphere of the sense world and rise up into regions that can only be grasped supersensibly. What we call Genesis does not begin with the portrayal of anything to do with sense perceptions, a portrayal of anything that could be seen with eyes in the external physical world, In the course of these lectures, we shall have ample chance to become convinced that we should be quite mistaken to take the words of the first sections of Genesis as referring to things or events which can be seen with the physical eye. Therefore, as long as you connect the words heaven and earth with anything containing a residue of the sensuously visible, you have not reached the dimension to which the first sections of Genesis are referring. Today there is practically no other way of throwing light upon the world it describes except through spiritual science. But with the spiritual scientific method, a certain possibility is there to approach what we might call the mystery of these primordial words with which the Bible opens and get a feeling for their content. What is their special character? If I may put it abstractly to begin with, their secret lies in the fact that they are written in the Hebrew tongue, a language which works upon the soul quite differently than any modern language can. Although the Hebrew of these early chapters may not work in the same way today, it did at one time have the effect that when a letter was sounded, it called up a picture in the soul. Pictures arose in the soul of someone who entered with living interest into the words and let them work upon them. Pictures harmoniously arranged, organic pictures, pictures which may be compared with what the seer can still see today when he proceeds from the realm of the senses to the realm of the supersensible. The Hebrew language, or to be more exact, the language of the first chapters of the Bible, enabled the soul to call up pictorial images very similar to those the seer encounters when freed from his body, he is able to look into supersensible regions of existence. Therefore, if we want to reach, in some measure, a living picture of these powerful primordial words, it is essential to forego all the pale and shadowy impressions which any modern language can have on us, and get an idea of the tremendously alive, creatively stimulating power inherent in any of the sound sequences in this ancient tongue. So it is of immense importance that in the course of these lectures, we really do attempt to conjure up those very pictures which arose in the Hebrew scholars of old, when a particular sound worked creatively within them, and the corresponding image arose. You see from this that there has to be an entirely different way of penetrating into this document than all those paths chosen today to understand ancient writings. This gives you an indication of our line of approach. It will be a slow and gradual process to acquire a living picture of what lived in the ancient Hebrew sages when they let those most powerful words work on them, which as words do at least still exist in the world. Our next task will be to stick as little as possible to what we already know and free ourselves as much as we can from the ideas we previously held when we talked about heaven and earth, the gods, creation, and a primordial beginning. The more we can liberate ourselves from the feelings we had toward these words, the better we shall be able to penetrate into the spirit of a document which arose out of quite different soul conditions than those of today. Above all, we must come to an agreement as to what we are talking about in the spiritual scientific sense when we speak about the opening words of the Bible. You know, of course, that it is possible for today's clairvoyant researcher to describe from a certain aspect the origin and evolution of our earth and of human existence. In my book titled An Outline of Esoteric Science, I endeavored to describe how the earth, as the scene, the planetary scene of the human race, gradually came into being through the three preliminary stages of evolution, the Saturn, Sun, and Moon stages. You will certainly be able to recapture, at least in broad outline, what was described there. The question is, at what point in the spiritual scientific account should we place the soul impression made on us by the mighty word Breshit? Where does it belong? Let us be clear about the way in which we can visualize the Saturn, Sun, and Moon existences. If we look back for a moment to ancient Saturn, we picture it as a cosmic body which does not yet possess anything of what we are used to calling material attributes. Of all that we find in our own environment, it has only the element of warmth, warmth or fire, the mobile element of warmth. No air or water or solid earth is yet to be found upon ancient Saturn. So that even where it is densest, it is living, weaving warmth. Then, as we know, existence advances to the so-called sun stage. To that mobile warmth, a kind of air or gaseous element is added. And we have a true picture of the planetary condition of the sun if we regard the elements of which it is composed as consisting of an interweaving and combining of gaseous, airy elements and warmth elements. The third condition in the evolution of our Earth is the so-called moon stage. Here, what we can call the element of water is added to the warmth and air. During the old moon stage, there is as yet nothing of what in our present Earth stage we call solid. However, during the moon stage, a special event occurs. The homogeneous character of the life of the planet now divides into two. Looking back upon old Saturn, we see it as a unified state of weaving warmth, and old Sun appears as an interweaving of the elements of gas and warmth. During the moon existence, a split occurs between what is of the nature of the sun and what is of the nature of the moon. It is only when we come to the fourth stage of our planetary evolution that we see the solid earth element added to the earlier elemental conditions of warmth, air, and water. So that this solid element could occur in the life of our planet, the division, which had previously taken place during the moon stage, had to be repeated. Once again, the sun element had to withdraw from the earth nature of the planet. Thus, at a certain moment in the evolution of our planet, the denser earthly element and the more delicate airy sun element separate out from a unified planetary condition where there was an interweaving of the elements of fire, air, and water. It is only in this newly arisen earthly element that a densification into the solid element could occur. Let us picture this moment when the sun withdraws from its unified planetary existence and, from now on, sends its forces down to the earthly element from outside. Let us bear in mind that this is what made it possible that within the earthly element, the solid element, which in a material sense we call solid, could begin to condense. If we focus on this moment, we have the point in time at which Genesis, the Bible, begins. This is what it is describing. We must not associate with the opening words of Genesis the abstract, shadowy ideas we think of when we utter the words "in the beginning." Compared with what the ancient Hebrew sage felt, it would be unspeakably poverty-stricken. If we want to fill our souls in the proper way with the sound Breshit, in the beginning, we must conjure up the whole picture of that twofoldness which came into being through the separating of the sun nature from earth nature. Everything that was there at the actual moment when the separation had just taken place. And further, we must also be aware that throughout the whole of the Saturn, Sun, and Moon stages, evolution was guided and carried by spiritual beings, and that what we call the elements of warmth, air, and water are always only the outer expression, the outer garments of the spiritual beings who are the reality of evolution. Even when we behold the condition existing at the moment of separation between the elements of sun and earth, and picture it to ourselves in thoughts full of material images, we must not forget that in all our picturing of the elements of water, air, and fire, we are seeing the expressions of the flowing world of spirituality, which, having progressed through the Saturn, Sun, and Moon stages, has now reached this particular point in evolution. Let us place before us the picture of an immense cosmic globe composed of weaving elements of water, air, and gas, and fire. And a globe which splits into a sun part and an earth part. But let us keep hold of the picture that everything we imagine as material elements is only a means of expression for spiritual beings. Let us imagine that from this substantial habitation, woven of the elements of water, air, and warmth, the countenances of spiritual beings weaving within it look out upon us, manifesting themselves to us in an element we grasp in thoughts of material images. Let us imagine we have before us spiritual beings looking toward us and who, with the force of their soul spiritual nature, are organizing cosmic bodies through the medium of warmth, air, and water. Let us stop and look at this picture. We have a picture of a sheath of elements, which, if we want to have an approximate visual picture of it, we can visualize as a snail shell, but a shell not formed of solid matter like a snail's, but woven out of the most delicate elements of water, air, and fire. Let us think of spiritual beings looking at us in the form of countenances, who both use this sheath as a means of revelation and are themselves a force of revelation, a force which, from the hidden world of the supersensible, pokes forth into manifestation, if I may use such an expression. If you call up in your mind's eye, EYE, this picture which I have just endeavored to paint for you, this living movement of spirit in a material element, and also envisage the inner soul force which causes it to happen, then concentrating on this to the exclusion of everything else, you will have something approximating what lived in an ancient Hebrew sage when the sounds breshit entered his soul. Bet, the first letter, called up the weaving together of the substance of the outer shell. Resh, the second accompanying sound, called up the countenances of the spiritual beings who did the weaving within the shell. And Shin, the third sound, called up the prickly force that was working its way out to manifestation. This is approximately how we arrive at the principle behind such a description. When we reach this, we are able to appreciate something of the spirit of this language, which combined with a creativity of soul of which the people of today, with their abstract languages, can have no idea. Let us now imagine ourselves concentrating fully on the moment in time prior to the physical coagulation, the physical densification of our earth, for this is what I want to describe. If we imagine this as vividly as we can, we shall have to admit that if we want to describe what is taking place there, we cannot apply any of the thought images we use today to describe processes in the external sense world. Therefore, it is utterly pretentious to associate with the second word we meet in Genesis any external factor, however closely it may resemble what we understand today as creating. In that way, we shall not get near to the meaning of this word. Where can we turn for help? The word does, in fact, imply something which lies very near the boundary where things of a sensuous nature pass over directly into the realm of the spiritual supersensible. And anyone who wants to grasp the meaning of the word, which is usually translated as, in quotes, created, parenthesis, in the beginning God created, close parenthesis, must not associate it in any way with a creative activity which can be seen with ordinary physical sense perception. My dear friends, look at your own being. Imagine you have been asleep for a while, and on waking you do not open your eyes to things around you, but through an inner activity fill your mind with certain mental images. Visualize this inner activity, this fertile thinking, which, as if by magic, conjures up soul substance from the depths of your soul. If you like, you can use the word excogitate for this conjuring up of soul substance out of the depths into the field of consciousness. And now, think of this activity, which human beings can do only in their mental images, as an activity that is actually on a cosmically creative scale. Instead of your own inner experience of thinking, imagine cosmic thinking. Then you have the content of the second word of Genesis, bara. Think of it as spiritually as you can, and bring it as close as you can to the life of thought which you see in your mind's eye, as close as you can. Reader's aside, bara is spelled B-A-R-A. End of reader's aside. And now, imagine that during your cogitating you bring two sets of mental images to mind. To make such a remote idea as clear as possible, think of a person who has been asleep, and when he wakes up two things occur to him, and he thinks about these two different kinds of things. Suppose the one kind of thought is the picture either of some activity or of some external thing or being, which does not enter his consciousness by way of outer perception, but through thinking, through creative soul activity. Suppose the second set of ideas occurring to the individual is a desire, something which the person's whole disposition and constitution can prompt him to will. So we have elements both of thought and of desire arising in our inner soul activity. Now imagine this inner activity happening not in the human soul, but in the beings called in Genesis the Elohim. Instead of the single human soul, imagine a multiplicity of spiritual beings thinking, and in a similar way, calling up out of their inner being two sets of images, which I would like to compare with what I have just been describing to you, an element of pure thought and an element of desire. So, instead of imagining a human soul thinking, we think of an organization of cosmic beings calling up in a similar way, except that their thinking is cosmic, two sets of mental images, one of the nature of thought, that is, one which reveals something by manifesting itself outwardly, and another of the nature of desire, full of inner activity. So let us picture the cosmic beings called the Elohim thinking in this fashion and realize that this is the picture of, in quotes, created, bara. And then let us imagine by means of this creative thinking two such sets of mental images arising, one of which is more of the nature of outer revelation, external manifestation, and another which is inwardly alive and active. Then we have approximately the two sets of mental images which arose in the souls of the ancient Hebrew sages when the words Hashamayim and Haaretz, represented nowadays by heaven and earth, sounded within them. Let us try as hard as we can to forget what present-day people think of as heaven and earth, and try to bring the two sets of mental images to mind. The set which tends more to manifest and to call forth an outer effect, and the set which is inwardly active, tending to remain as an inner experience. Then we have the essence of Hashamayim and Haaretz. And the Elohim themselves What kind of beings are they? In the course of these lectures, we shall get to know them better and describe them in terms of spiritual science. But for the present, let us try to reach, in some measure, the meaning of this primordial word, Elohim. If we want a picture of what lived in the souls of the ancient Hebrew sages when they used this word, you must realize that in those days, people were thoroughly aware that our earth evolution had its own meaning, its specific goal. What is this purpose, this goal? Our earth evolution can have a meaning only if during its course something arises which was not there before. A perpetual repetition of what was already there would be a meaningless existence, and the ancient Hebrew sages would have regarded earth genesis as without meaning unless they had known that the earth, after it had progressed through previous stages, had to bring something new into existence which had never been there before. Earth evolution provided the possibility for something new, namely that human beings became exactly the kind of beings they have become in the course of this evolution. In none of the earlier stages of evolution was man present as the being he is today, the being he will increasingly become in far-reaching future perspectives, for that was not possible in earlier stages. Those spiritual beings who guided and supported the manifestations of evolution, we call the Saturn, Sun, and Moon stages, were of a different nature from man. For the moment, we will not enter into the question of whether they were higher or lower. What is the best way to come to an understanding of the nature of those beings who were at work in the fiery, gaseous, and watery elements of the earlier stages of existence, composing the Saturn, Sun, and Moon existence, and the beginning of Earth existence? How can we draw near to them? We should have to go into a very great number of things to get anywhere near an understanding of these beings. To begin with, however, we can acquaint ourselves with one aspect of them, and that will suffice to bring us at least one step nearer to the potent conception of the primordial Bible words. Let us consider those beings who in a certain sense were nearest to man at the moment he was brought forth from what had evolved during the ancient Saturn, Sun, and Moon stages. Let us ask these beings about their actual intentions. Let us ask them what their will and purpose was. Then we shall be able to get at least some idea of their nature. What was it they intended doing? They could do many things. In the course of their evolution, they had acquired capacities in one direction or another. One of them could do this, another that. But we understand the nature of these beings best if we realize that at the time we are now considering, they were working as a group toward a common goal. It is, at a higher level, as though a group of human beings, each with their own special skill, were to cooperate today. Each of them has an ability in some direction, and they now say to one another, "You can do this, I can do that, and he can do the other. Let us pool all our activities to carry out a joint action in which each of us can be active." So let us imagine such a group of human beings, each of whom has a different capacity, but who have a common aim. What they intend bringing into being is not yet there. The object of their endeavors consists at the moment only of an aim and does not exist as yet. What is there is a multiplicity, and the unit lives initially in the form of an ideal. Now think of a group of spiritual beings who have passed through the evolution of Saturn, Sun, and Moon, each one of whom has a specific ability, and who at the moment I have indicated come to the decision, "We will combine our activities for a common end. We will all work in the one direction." And the picture of this goal arose before each of them. What was this goal? It was man, earthly man. Thus earthly man existed as the goal among a group of divine spiritual beings who had resolved to combine their several skills to arrive at something which they themselves did not have at all, but which they were able to create by combined effort. If you put together all that I have described to you, the elemental sheath and spiritual beings active within it, thinking cosmic thoughts in the form of two complexes, one inwardly active and the other manifesting outwardly, and then ascribe the common purpose I have just mentioned to those spiritual beings, whose countenances look out, as it were, from out of the elemental sheath, then you have what lived in the hearts of the Hebrew sages of old, with the word Elohim. Thus we have brought before us in picture form what lives in all these all-powerful primordial words. So let us forget all that a modern person can feel and think when he pronounces the words, quote, "In the beginning God created the heaven and the earth," close quote. Bearing in mind all that I have told you today, try to put this picture before you. There is a sphere in which fiery, gaseous, and watery elements weave, and within this active weaving, elemental sphere, there is a group of spiritual beings who are engaged in thinking creatively. And the goal of their creative thinking is to direct the whole force of their joint activity toward the image of man. The first fruit of their thinking is the conception of something manifesting itself outwardly and of something else inwardly active. In the elemental sheath, the primordial spirits brought into being out of themselves the creative thought of a process outwardly manifesting, a process inwardly active. Try to picture in these terms what is said in the opening lines of the Bible, for here we have the foundation of all we shall be looking at in the next few days regarding the true significance of those all-powerful primordial words which are for humankind such a tremendous revelation, the revelation of our own origin. The end of Lecture 1.